Well, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation to be here. I think I spoke to the English Catholic History Association many, many years ago. Did you want to meet up in Westminster in Kensington, Our Lady of Victories? No? Okay, possibly, yeah, many years ago. Yeah, yeah. So one of the lesser known stories coming out of the First World War is that of Catholic military chaplains, non-combatant priests who accompanied soldiers into the trenches, said mass for sailors on board dreadnoughts and blessed intrepid flyers before they took off in their cardboard and string aeroplanes. It's likely that if one of your Catholic ancestors or relatives fought in the First World War, he came across a Catholic chaplain, a Catholic padre. Now, Tom Johnston and I, in 1996, produced a book called The Cross and the Sword. And basically, it was the first book to study Catholic chaplains at that time. Now, since that time, thankfully, there have been lots and lots of research done by academics and by postgrads and by undergraduate students. And over the years, more and more has been revealed about these brave priests who went to be chaplains in the First World War, and indeed in other wars as well. And it has to be remembered that these padres, these chaplains, experienced the same harrowing scenes that every other man saw in the First World War. They saw the same harrowing scenes of death and destruction, people with limbs blown off, people with faces torn apart. And they had to exercise their priestly ministry in a way that none of them could have ever imagined. So their story is worth telling. And this afternoon, what I shall just try to do in the 45 minutes so available is just give you a kind of a glimpse, kind of a flavour of what it was like for those men in the First World War in particular. The title is Priests in Uniform. Now you might say, well, the man on the left is not in a uniform. Well, he's a Navy chaplain. And in those days, Navy chaplains didn't wear uniforms. They wore their normal priestly garb. We have an Army chaplain to the right over there, talking to a wounded man, probably taking notes of his relatives or whatever, maybe writing a letter home for him. In the middle, we have a padre of unknown denomination speaking to a group of airmen. And the Royal Flying Corps, the Royal Air Forces, in its early days, of course, in those days, but they were still treated as the rest of the British Army and received chaplaincy support from the Army chaplains until they were established as a separate unit later on. The priest on the left is a Benedictine monk from Fort Augustus, and I'll come back to him later on. So, Catholic priests were not new to the British forces in 1914. They had been first commissioned as army chaplains in 1858, 2 years after the end of the Crimean War. And their bravery in the Crimean War, their service in the Crimean War, was one of the reasons why they were, in fact, given commissions on equal status with chaplains of other denominations, and particularly the Anglicans. During the second half of the 19th century, Catholic priests served as uniformed officers in garrisons and in conflict across the British Empire. From 1899 to 1902, they ministered with great distinction in the South African War, and by the outbreak of the Great War in 1914, some Catholic chaplains had considerable military experience. Like all military chaplains, Catholic chaplains were subject to two sources of authority, one military, one ecclesiastical. Army chaplains were subject to the War Office via the Adjutant General, and then via the Army Chaplains Department. The Admiralty was in charge of chaplains to the Royal Navy. And they're a separate story, very separate story, as I'll try to explain later on. There were no commissioned Catholic chaplains to the Royal Navy until about 1943. So throughout the 1914-18 war, their commissions were, shall we say, officiating and then temporary acting. It was very, very confusing. The only conclusion you can draw from all that is that the Admiralty didn't want Catholic chaplains. From the 1850s, the Bishop of Southwark had been the bishop in charge of Catholic military chaplains. So when the chaplains went out as volunteers without commission in 1854 to the Crimean War, they were given their faculties via Bishop Thomas Grant of Southwark. The reason why he was chosen for that onerous responsibility was perhaps because all the major naval bases and army bases were on the south coast, and Southwark Diocese was basically the south of England in 1850. And his father had been a soldier as well, so they may have thought that was a useful fact in his favour. But in the early 1900s, in 1903 and 1906 in particular, all ecclesiastical responsibility for military chaplains, both army and navy, was vested in the Archbishop of Westminster, Archbishop Francis Bourne, who prior to that had been the Bishop of Southwark. So he'd already got some experience of handling military chaplains and dealing with chaplaincy affairs. Coming to the structure of the Army Chaplains Department in 1914, there are four sets of chaplains, as you can see there from the screen. The first set are the commissioned chaplains to the forces. And you can see from that they have rank. They have class, and according to that class, they have a rank, which equated with pay, with conditions, and with pension. The chaplain general with the rank of brigadier general was always an Anglican. And as we'll see later, the majority of chaplains to the British Army were Anglican. So we have the four classes underneath the chaplain general. 1, 2, 3, and 4 with the equivalent rank. Underneath that, you had what we call acting chaplains, non-commissioned chaplains, but who actually gave all their time to the army in bases, Portsmouth, Hornsey, Salisbury Plain, that kind of place. But they gave all their time to the army, but they were still diocesan priests. They didn't have commissions. They were commissioned on the 30th of August 1914, when it became obvious that we didn't have enough commissioned chaplains to go out with the British Expeditionary Force across to France and to Belgium. Third section were the chaplains to the territorial force, and there were lots of territorial garrisons all over the British Isles. And so these guys would be officiating men, people would be paid on a per capita basis, non-uniformed, non-commissioned. And then finally, the honorary chaplains, the ones who were ex-chaplains, if you like, people like Robert Brindle, the Bishop of Nottingham, who was a very experienced chaplain, who had been in the Sudan, in Khartoum with Kitchener, and he'd got the DSO, and he was a very well-decorated army chaplain, and finished with the rank of first class colonel. Okay, so that was Bishop Robert Brindle, I beg your pardon. In 1914, the army was about 247,000 strong. I've tried to get some idea of the number of Catholics in there. It's very difficult, very difficult. People always say, well, the British Army is 70% Anglican. The rest. We don't know who the rest were. But of course, were Presbyterians, Wesleyans, Baptists, Catholics, and by the end of the First World War, Jewish. So by the end of the First World War, we had rabbis as chaplains as well. But from our own denomination, in the regular army, about 20,000. In the reserve, about 30,000. I don't know how many the territorials. It's very difficult to get figures on this. What was the Army Chaplains Department like in 1914? Well, there were 113 commissioned chaplains, 88 Anglican, 15 Roman Catholic, 10 Presbyterian, all allotted by the Army according to distinct proportions. The Army doesn't do anything approximately, it does everything right. So if there were X Army, X Anglicans, you've got X Anglican chaplains. If you were Y Catholics, you've got Y Catholic chaplains, and so on. So there's always that proportional difference between the chaplains as the war moved on. Now, in addition to the commissioned chaplains, and we're not all in one place, by the way, given if you remember where the British Empire spread in 1914, they were all over the world. So they couldn't all go out to the with the BEF to France in 1914 in August. So they were commissioned underneath those, the acting chaplains, honorary chaplains, and so forth. And basically, the ones who were commissioned to go to France were these people, the acting ones, because the honorary ones were basically too old to go out there. When the British Army went to France, and there were about 80,000 men, give or take, a few thousand, 53 chaplains were deployed with them. 53 chaplains for 80,000 men. 30 Anglican, 10 Catholic, 9 Presbyterian, 4 Wesleyan. And all of them were commissioned chaplains. All had seen experience, not of war perhaps, but certainly of the military. And that made a big difference. And they were all commissioned men. Of the Catholics, you can see the breakdown there, the four ranks, the four classes. One colonel, two lieutenant colonel, second class, three majors and four captains. This man, Monsignor William Lewis Keating, he didn't have the CMG when he first went out to France in August 1914, but he had it when he finished the war in 1918, most certainly. He was a priest of the Southwark Diocese. He was ordained in 1893 and commissioned in 1897. He served in the Boer War at the Battle of Colenso and the relief of Ladysmith, and subsequently served at Aldershot, Gosport, Portsmouth, Shawcliffe, Malta, and Egypt, which is where he was when war was declared on the 4th of August 1914. So being the most senior and the most experienced Catholic chaplain, he was brought back immediately and sent out with the BEF to France, along with others, the other nine. And Monsignor Keating, who was educated here in this school, the downside, was with the retreat, with the British Army that retreated from Mons. You know about the Schlieffen Plan and the retreat from the north down south to Ain and the Marne. He was with the British Expeditionary Force as they retreated. And his letters tell of the time when they were on the march for days on end because of the Germans coming at them. Even though the Munsters and the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry tried to hold up the advancing Germans to allow the British Army to move south, he was with them along with others. And for days they didn't sleep, they didn't wash. If people died, they were left by the wayside. If they were wounded, they were left by the wayside if they couldn't be carried. And I don't think people realise what a great humiliation the retreat from Mons was to the British Army. But it was an enormous retreat. Monsignor Keating was a principal chaplain. Assistant principal chaplain. Principal chaplain was a man called Dr. Sims, who was an Ulster Presbyterian in charge of all the chaplains. And he was an assistant principal chaplain with responsibility for Catholics, Catholic chaplains, and their ministry to the troops. Where did the chaplains come from? Because the volunteers among the priests, the volunteers who wanted to become chaplains, was almost equivalent in terms of enthusiasm with that of ordinary men who left mills and factories and shops and wanted to join up. And a lot of the younger priests, particularly, saw this as something different. You know, if you'd been stuck in here for 10 years and you know, all you'd seen was Downside Abbey and its, you know, environs, and suddenly, you know, a chance to get away, a chance to fight, a chance to be with the men. It was a very attractive proposition. And so a lot of priests went to volunteer. However, how many of them were taken and from what kind of source were they taken? Well, you can see there, 49 dioceses across England, Wales, Ireland and Scotland, totaling 8,000 priests. By the end of the war, if we add both seculars and the regulars together, nearly 10% of all Catholic priests in the British Isles had become Catholic military chaplains, which is a huge percentage, huge percentage. So if you look at the diocese in England and Wales, nearly 4,000 priests, Scotland, many fewer, 27 dioceses in Ireland with 3,500 priests. 49 dioceses give you 8,000 priests. What I've not added on are these people down here. Because remember, in those days, there were many, many male religious orders of big communities, huge communities. And they had men who wanted to volunteer as well. And across the British Isles. So we've got Irish Jesuits coming forward. We've got Marist Fathers, Benedictines, Dominicans, Carmelites, all sending men off to be military chaplains. And of course, from the Empire, Canada, the Australia, New Zealand Army Corps, the Anzac Corps, and the missionary institutes in Africa and India, they too sent men to be chaplains. If you read King's regulations, or now Queen's regulations, about the function, the role and function of military chaplains, they're very different from what you would expect a priest would do. They talk about keeping morale and and discipline and good order and reading divine office and that kind of thing. Very Anglican. But of course, a priest would not see his role and function as somebody who kept morale, or who kept discipline, or who kept order. His role and function was to give spiritual support and consolation through the sacraments. And the chaplain's role was essentially one of providing the sacramental means whereby a soldier's soul would be saved. And those ministrations would be provided before, during and after battle, to the living, to the wounded, and to the dead. So the chaplain's role was basically a priest, but in a uniform, but in very different circumstances from a normal priest in a mission as they then were. Each chaplain would carry a mess kit. I'm sorry about the screen, it's got a bit of a kink in it, hasn't it, the screen? This mess kit would be carried by all chaplains, and the War Office provided them, paid for them, right? And it's just a box with a very heavy altar stone, two candelabra there, and a crucifix. The priest would also have the other essentials for Mass, chalice, ciborium, and of course a paten, and all the altar linen. Because the priest had to say Mass, I won't say as the same, but as much as the same as he could say. So as we'll see later, the photograph of a priest saying Mass on the beach at Gallipoli, very different from saying Mass in, shall we say, the Abbey, but the elements of the Mass, the essentials of the Mass are just the same. So this Mass kit was essential for the padre, who would have a batman because he was an officer. So the batman would be responsible for all this, for the vestments, and for generally ensuring that he had, for example, enough hosts, enough wine, enough of the viaticum. Because when you think of the number of times these chaplains, in the course of 4 years, administered the last rites to somebody, you'd need an awful lot of oil to do that. So the chaplain was a man who brought spiritual support and consolation through Mass, sacraments, the benediction, the rosary, to the Catholic Church. If you think of the sacrament of penance as we mature people would recognise it, going into a box, kneeling down, saying your confession in confidence, in privacy, that didn't happen all the time on the Western Front. So a priest might be walking along the men as they walk to the trenches, listening to confessions. If they couldn't get confession, he would give them a general absolution before they went into battle. So the actual administration, or the ministration of the sacraments, was very, very different from what any of them had been used to, except the ones who had been, shall we say, in the Boer War, or with Kitchener at Khartoum, or in some of the African conflicts, if Afghanistan, for example. So he was there to administer the sacraments, but not quite in the same way that he would have done had he been in a parish. Now, of course, all religious ceremonies, whatever, came secondary to military priorities. No question about it. If the commanding officer said no, that was it. If the captain of a ship said no, that was it. Because all military priorities took priority. The one on the right there is a chaplain, again, of unknown denomination. Looks like Catholic, doesn't it? Setting up an altar in a hut. There were huts in the various bases around France. There were also huts in the various training camps around England and the British Isles. And the chaplains would make as much as they could out of the given situation. And the given situation very often was not something that they were used to, but they made the best job of it. What did they do? Well, I mentioned before the priest saying Mass on the beaches at Gallipoli. We'll come on to the Gallipoli campaign a bit later, but this priest is saying Mass in full vestments on the beaches at Gallipoli. Now, to me, it was a very brave man, A, for being a chaplain, but B, for saying Mass on the beaches at Gallipoli when there were probably thousands of Turkish snipers all over the place, and he's got his colourful vestments on. Well, he must have been an absolute his target, wasn't he, really? But anyway, maybe I'm stretching that a bit too far. So we have the chaplain at work saying Mass on the beaches at Gallipoli. And that's where many of the men finished up, on the beaches at Gallipoli, because they didn't have time to bury them or places to bury them until much, much later. At the other side, we've got a chaplain. He looks like a chaplain, the man there, yeah? Looks so he's got a clerical collar on, it might be bandage. My question, if he's a chaplain and he's supposed to be working, why is he sitting down? He could be injured himself, I don't know. But the chaplains were asked to go to the dressing stations. First aid post, then the dressing stations, then the base hospitals. That's where they were supposed to go, because that's where people thought would be most needed and most useful. They were not encouraged to go up to the front, into the front lines, the trenches. But many of them ignored that order and did just that. And then finally, of course, the number of times chaplains had to bury men was, well, innumerable. These ones are lucky, because these look to have been buried in graves which look to be well-tended and neat and tidy. You think of Tyne Cot Memorial at Passchendaele, 57,000 names on the marble behind. They were never found. 57,000, that's just one memorial. Go to Tiet Ballets, I don't think there are as many, but it's certainly a large number. So the priests had to say Mass, give comfort and assistance in medical stations, and then bury troops when dead. The first army chaplain to die in the First World War was Father William Finn from the Diocese of Middlesbrough. And Father Finn was commissioned in November 1914 and was with the 1st Royal Dublin Fusiliers as they disembarked at Gallipoli on the 25th of April 1915 from the sides of a converted steamer called the SS River Clyde. And this was the first amphibious landing undertaken by the British Army, I believe. And Father Thynne was told that he shouldn't go ashore with the troops. They would get ashore, then he would follow with medics and what have you. But he was adamant that he went down the ramp with the men, and he did. And he was killed. Now, there are many stories about how this man was killed. Some say that as he hit the beach, he was injured in the arm. But he dragged himself round the beach, giving blessing and extreme unction to men as he could. Others say he received a shrapnel wound to the head. No, I've never received a shrapnel wound to the head, but it can't be comfortable. And I don't think he would have been able to crawl around the beach, having been hit like that, doing the things that people claim he did. And there were lots of different stories about how he was killed. Suffice to say that he was killed, and he was buried on the beach in a shallow grave by another priest from Ushaw College in Durham. Father Thynne became a Catholic hero overnight. He was a priest, he was unarmed, he was with men going into battle, and he suffered and he played the ultimate sacrifice. And if you think that in 1908, the Catholics were not allowed to have a procession in London because of the opposition from the establishment. But yet here, six years later, we've got thousands and thousands of Catholic men and priests dying in the name and for the sake of their country. So Father Thynne, if you like, became something of a hero almost overnight by being with the Dublin Fusiliers. And they're themselves, the Dublin Fusiliers, Irishmen fighting for the British Empire. That in itself could be seen as a contradiction in terms at that time. So when the Gallipoli campaign was a disaster, as you probably all know, lasted from January 1915 to December 1915. And as the French, British, Russian and Australian New Zealand troops withdrew from Gallipoli in late 1915, Father Thynne's body was in a shallow grave on the beach, at V Beach. And now, of course, like all his other colleagues who were killed, he's in a proper grave at V Beach Cemetery. He was one of 37 Catholic chaplains to serve in the Dardanelles. 37. Now, if you know any military history, the Dardanelles campaign was a shambles from start to finish. And not only that, it was a bloody shambles, carnage, writ large. And there were 37 priests there. As far as I know, Father Thynne was the only one to die. Another one who died was Father John Gwynn, an Irish Jesuit, was with the Irish Guards. He'd been wounded in early 1915 when serving with the Irish Guards on the Western Front. But again, he was wounded on the 11th of October 1915 at a place called Vermel and died on the following day at Bethune. Now, this illustration gives the impression that Father Gwynne, was on the field in his saintly, heroic look, calmly looking up to heaven and blessing a dying German soldier. And you have to contrast the look on the Padre's face with the look of the German. This was sheer propaganda, wasn't it? You know, Catholic priest, you can see his Roman colleague, you can see the crucifix, smartly in uniform, looking to heaven, giving a blessing to the enemy, who doesn't look all that human, does he, when you think about it? You look at his face, kind of a barbaric look about him. And it was sheer propaganda. Because actually Father Gwynne was with the officers and they were having lunch and a bomb exploded outside their dugout and he was badly injured. And he was taken down, badly injured, to the dressing post, first aid post, whatever, and he died on the following day. So that is a fabrication. That comes from a book called The War Illustrated, which was a series of weekly magazines all bound together at the end of the war and sold in huge numbers. But it was good propaganda. He was Irish, he was Catholic, he was a priest, he was unarmed, he was on the battlefield and he was giving succour to the enemy. So, rather grim, an Irish hero. And of course, this man became the epitome, if you like, or the of the hero chaplain. The Anglicans had Reverend Edward Mellish, and I think four other VCs, men who got VCs in the Anglican chaplain's department. They had Reverend Gerald Studdett Kennedy, Woodbine Willie, you've probably all heard of Woodbine Willie, who offered woodbines to priests, to men when they were dying and injured. But this guy became the paradigm of the English, British hero chaplain. He served with the 8th Royal Dublin Fusiliers in France and was killed in November 1917, part of the Battle of Passchendaele, actually called the Battle of Langemarck, where he was killed. He'd already been awarded the Military Cross for his bravery, and it was argued that because he died in battle and his previous exploits, he should have been awarded the Victoria Cross. And it didn't happen, and his supporters like to think, and people have thought this since, it didn't happen for three reasons. First of all, he was Irish. Secondly, because he was a Catholic. And thirdly, because he was a Jesuit. Now, that might be stretching it a little too far, because there were lots of Irish Catholics who'd been given the VC prior to Father Doyle being killed. But none, of course, had been Irish Catholic Jesuits, unless you go back and talk about Father John Gwynn. But Father John Gwynn wasn't in the same league in terms of apparent bravery for over a longer period of time than this man was. And there's all kinds of things written about Father Doyle, Willie Doyle. He wrote some beautiful stuff. I mean, if you ever get a chance to read some of his spiritual works, lovely stuff to read. Really, really was a very able man and a great, great loss to the Jesuits in Ireland, to the Irish province. He died on the 17th of November 1917, but his body was never found. But you will find his name on the Tyne Court Memorial at Passchendaele. Moving on to Navy chaplains. You'll notice that these two are both Benedictines. And each got a story. We'll deal with the one on the left first of all. Dom Basil Gwydir from Dowie Abbey, but he was actually based at St David's, I think, in Swansea. And he volunteered for Navy chaplaincy at the very beginning of the war. And he was on board the HMT, the hospital ship Rohilla, going back to France from Scotland to pick up wounded and bring them back. And as it was going south off the Yorkshire coast, it sank in a storm in October 1914. And Father Gwydir stayed with the wounded, or the people who were on board who were wounded at that time, yeah, they were, yeah. And he was drowned. Now, there are one or two discrepancies, you probably heard that in my statement. He stayed with the wounded, but yet the ship was going to France to bring back wounded. So where did the wounded come from? And this is the problem you get some of these stories, that they're not consistent. So if he was going to Scotland, to France, to bring back wounded, there wouldn't have been any wounded on board, would they? He may have stayed on board with other people. That's a different thing altogether. He might not have been able to get off the ship. That's another thing altogether. But whatever, he was drowned. So he was the first Catholic chaplain to die in the war. Not Father Finn, as people always claim to be. He was the first one to die. A Benedictine. Now, the other one is Aidan Weld Blundell from Fort Augustus Abbey in Scotland. And they had been ministering to the British Navy in the northern reaches since about 1906. But there'd always been a problem with the Admiralty. The Admiralty didn't want Catholic priests on board ships. And their lordships stuck out to have them kept off the ships. The problem was, there were now Catholic captains of ships, and there were now lots and lots of Catholic men in the Navy who demanded chaplains. And so it was arranged that at least in the waters where ships were anchored, Scapa Flow, Lamlash, Rosyth, and all those big navy areas, that local priests would go and officiate. But the Benedictines at Fort Augustus managed to get on board ships, and Adrian Well-Blondel actually became part of the officers' mess on one or two of the ships. But being a navy chaplain was very, very difficult. You can imagine the number of ships that we had in those days and the size of them. They were huge, vast things. And to get across from one ship to another in Scapa Flow, for example, or in Cromarty Firth, was not an easy thing to do. You were dependent on lighters to take you from one to the other. You were dependent on captains allowing you on board. You were dependent on naval precedence taking over, because ships would come in, coal up, and then go out again. But yet thousands of the stokers were Catholic men who expected their priest to give them the kind of support, spiritual succour that they needed. So whereas the army chaplains totaled well over 800 by the end of the war, there were never more than about 30 navy chaplains. So the vast, vast Royal Navy. If you ever look at the reviews at Spithead or something like that, pre-war, immediately about around that time, huge numbers of ships, huge numbers. You don't realise how big the Navy was in those days. The second Navy chaplain to die was an Oblate of Mary Immaculate, Father Stuart Phelan, Irish, who died on the 31st of May 1916 at the Battle of Jutland. Before the war, he'd served in Leeds at Mount St Mary's, which is a very, very strong Oblate area. And Father Phelan had served on a number of ships in the Grand Fleet before the Battle of Jutland. But at the Battle of Jutland, he was on HMS Black Prince. And he was one of about six or seven Catholic chaplains with the fleet that day. Probably six more than seven. Anyway, the Black Prince became detached from its squadron. And it was chased and caught by German ships and pounded into oblivion, basically. And 662 officers and men of Black Prince were killed. One of them was Father Phelan, and another one was his Anglican counterpart. So there were two chaplains on board that big ship. If you read Gordon Taylor's book, Sea Chaplains, he mentions Battle of Jutland. He mentions the Anglican chaplain by name on the Black Prince. He does not mention Father Stuart Phelan. Now, elsewhere in this battle, which is the only big battle, really, fought by the two fleets in the war, there was Father Anthony Pollen, an Oratorian from Birmingham. And he was on HMS Warspite. Now, you've got to imagine this thing, this action taking place, seas going up and down, ships going up and down, shells coming at it from all kinds of angles and distances and with velocities. And you can imagine a ship being hit. It's like, being encased in here and a high velocity shell coming in and boom, everything goes off. So there's bits of everything flying over the place. Father Pollen was on the warspite and this battery, this two-gun battery had been hit. And the men were burning. And Pollen went into the battery, into the gun, picked the two men up, covered them up with his clothes, and carried them out. And in so doing, he was severely burned as well. he was given the Distinguished Service Cross for bravery. Now, some people would have said, well, that deserved a bit more. But again, the Navy, the Army, they have their rules and they have their view on things. So he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for bravery. That's Anthony Pollan of the Oratory in Birmingham. Another priest, I can't remember his name now, whose diary is in the Imperial War Museum, he was on the dock side at Rosyth when the war spike came in, and he saw Father Pollan swathed in bandages. All he could see were his eyes. He was in such a bad state due to his burns. Right, where do we go now? Benedictine contribution. I thought I might just slant it a little bit, being in Downside, and having written this many years ago, and it's on the web if people want to get it. It's on the web, is that, for people to look at. I thought I'd just do a kind of a Benedictine slant. And this is a list of the number of priests who came from each abbey who served in the First World War as chaplains. So from here, 13. Okay? Now, I don't know what proportion of that was in relation to the proportion of monks who lived here at the time, but I would think it'd be fairly high. And of course, they were all young men who went. So an abbot, or abbots and superiors and bishops, wouldn't have been too happy about losing all their young guys to go off and risk death after they'd invested, you know, 7 or 8 years of their money in training them up to be priests. So you can imagine bishops and superiors thinking, well, yeah, we want to support the cause. However, we don't really want to lose A, B or C because they are our best men, young men at that. So this was the contribution from the various abbeys. And it's for both Army and Royal Navy. Two pictures here are of men who are from this community. Father Stephen Rawlinson, I mentioned him earlier to you, and Ambrose Agius. And if you buy this book, they're in this book. Their pictures are in this book, Rawlinson and Ambrose Agius. And Stephen Rawlinson, Bernard Stephen Rawlinson, had ministered in the Boer War as a chaplain. And he immediately volunteered at the outbreak of war in 1914 and went off to the front with other people who had been commissioned already or had held commissions previously. Father Rawlinson became principal chaplain on the Western Front, charging all chaplains who were not Anglicans. He got a huge responsibility, and by the end of the war he got all kinds of medals and decorations. He didn't get a DSO, he got a CMG. He might have got a DSO, he's mentioned in dispatches innumerable times. He got all the campaign medals, obviously, but he had Boer War medals as well. So you look at him and you think, apart from the dog collar, this guy could be a field marshal, certainly a general. So he got to the rank of Colonel, first class, lots of medals, lots of responsibility, and lots of respect. He's a very able man, and he was responsible at first for being the assistant principal chaplain to Monsignor Keating, in charge of Catholic chaplains, but in 1915, the Army Chaplains Department on the Western Front was divided up. And the Anglicans took all their men off to one side and left the others to get on with it. And Rawlinson became the assistant principal chaplain to the other side, as it were, with responsibility for Catholic chaplains, Presbyterians, Methodists, Wesleyans, the whole business. And he was very well respected for that. He came back here, and in the Second World War he joined up again. I don't know how old he was, but he must have been knocking on a bit. But he served on the home front in the Second World War. So it'd been the Boer War, the First War and the Second War. And you have to wonder where this guy's loyalties really were. And it was, of course, being a chaplain, being a priest with the military. which in itself was a different pastorate, a different kind of element to the priestly life. The other one is Ambrose Aegius. Now, he does have his own website, this guy. His family are put stuff on the web. And if you go on there, you get that picture. But Ambrose Aegius was a poet, very sensitive man. And after the war, during the war and after the war, he wrote up some of his experiences, some of his feelings, some of his sentiments, if you like, in poetry. And they are equal to anything you've read from, you know, Mr. Sue or anybody like that. This man was a priest, you know, and he put his thoughts down in poems. The man in the middle is Father Michael Umberto Bertini, who again was a Benedictine from Farnborough, and he died in service. So you had Basil Guidea, you had Michael Bertini, two Benedictines who died in service. But of course there were others who did what these two men did, or what these three men did. You know, were active priests in the ministry, in very, very difficult conditions, in the trenches, in hospitals, seeing all the kinds of things they would never expect to see, and performing their ministry in a place, at a time, in conditions which they would never, ever expect. So what was the contribution then of priests and to the army and to the Royal Navy? By the end of the war, 840 regular and temporary commissions had been given out to Catholic priests to serve as military chaplains. 35 chaplains served as officiating chaplains to the Royal Navy, despite the thousands and thousands of Irishmen in particular who were in the Royal Navy in the First World War. You can see how complicated the Navy made it. In September 1921, Catholic priests were granted temporary commissions as acting Roman Catholic chaplains. So temporary and acting. Now, vague, yes. Yeah. Nothing definite about that, is there? You're temporary, you're acting. In other words, you might be out tomorrow, but you're certainly not permanent, you're certainly not commissioned. And it wasn't until 1922 that the acting bit was taken out and the temporary bit was added. Now that equated, that bit there, equated with the fourth class people who joined the army in 1914. They were only given temporary commissions. So by that time, by 1922, if you like, the army and the navy were on a parity when it came to giving commissions. Royal Navy chaplains were not given regular commissions until 1943, 3 years into the Second World War. If we look at this side here, those killed in action, who died in service or of wounds. In the Royal Navy, one Benedictine, one Oblate of Mary Immaculate. 36 in the army, so in total 38 men killed, 38 priests. 10 SJs, Irish and English province. And when at the end of the war, Father Rawlinson was trying to work through the demobilisation process and get the priests back out of the army into their monasteries or into their dioceses, he wrote to the superiors of the Jesuits and said, nobody can complain about your contribution to army chaplaincy in this war because you've been outstanding. Outstanding. And if you look at the list of contributions between some of the religious orders and some of the dioceses across Ireland particularly, and there's a reason why they wouldn't do it, some of the Irish dioceses were most reluctant to let men go off to be chaplains to the British Army for obvious reasons. But if you look across the kind of range there of deaths, the Society of Jesus, Liverpool Archdiocese, Franciscans, Waterford, Benedictines, Carmelites, Redemptorists. These are all from the army, of course. And then one each from all of these other diaries and orders down here. In addition to the five Commonwealth chaplains who were killed. So a huge contribution from the diocese, from religious orders, to the role of chaplains, to chaplaincy, to the British forces in the First World War. This picture, again, is a very famous one. It's the blessing of, no, it's the last absolution given to the Munsters by Father Francis Gleeson of the Dublin Archdiocese before the Battle of Aubers Ridge in 1915. Now, I've read Father Gleeson's diary, and it doesn't say anything about the men singing the Te Deum. But other people say that the men actually sang the Te Deum after they'd been given the last absolution by Father Gleeson. Now, I don't know the Te Deum, do you? Anybody here know the Te Deum?
Yeah.
Good. Good, very good.
Used to be able to.
Used to be able to. Maybe ordinary soldiers, maybe ordinary people at that time, I don't know, what taught the Te Deum. I find it hard to believe, but maybe they were. They might have something of glory at St. Patrick, and, you know, that's a good thing. Fine. Anyway, this painting again became, if you like, iconic for British Army chaplaincy in the First World War. So you've got Father Gleeson with the officers at this wayside shrine on the way to the Battle of Aubers Ridge in May, June 1915, receiving the last absolution. In other words, this man is forgiving all their sins, whether they've been to individual confession or not. And a general absolution wasn't something lightly given, so faculties were extended to the priest to allow that. What's also interesting are the comments made by Haig, Field Marshal Haig, in his final dispatch about military chaplains. At the end of the Crimean War, there were those mischievous people who liked to divide the Catholic chaplains from the rest. And they tried to make out that there had been a lot of enmity, disharmony between the Catholic chaplains and the Anglican chaplains. Not so, really. Not so. A lot of them had gone through the same kind of experiences at Balaclava and the rest. And, you know, they were not for dividing. They were for working together. And there's a kind of a something about that still there in these words. But first of all, he talks about building up the indomitable spirits of the army. Well, Catholic priests might not have signed up for that. They would want people to be in good morale, but they wouldn't say that was their function, to go in there and be morale boosters, to preach the cause, or the goodness of the cause, or the justness of the cause. I've only ever seen one reference to a man, to a priest rather, talking up the cause before battle. Tended mainly to be spiritual, sacramental, and not political. But he talks down here about their teaching and the objects for which they were fighting. Well, the bishops at home most certainly did. You read any of Bishop Burton's pastorals, or Bourne, or Calgary Leeds. And they're up for it. The Huns, you know, they're up for it. British Empire, the cause, end of civilization as we know it, it's our duty to fight. They were up for it. But I don't get that kind of impression from the chaplains. Nor do I get it from a lot of the men either. But you get it, of course, in the tablet, as you would, and presumably in other Catholic papers as well. And finally, worked for the common good in a manner admirable, noteworthy, absence of friction. That's the Crimean War bit. These two, morale and spirit and the noble cause. There's no doubt about it that some of the chaplains worked well together, some of them didn't get on. There's a Father Bernard Marshall from Northampton Diocese, and he complains bitterly about the Anglicans marching up and then kicking off next door with a drumhead service and divine service, which he regards as total heresy, and he can't be doing with it. And you get other priests who say, well, I didn't have much to do with the Anglican chaplains. So we had to share a dugout, but that was about it. But on the other hand, you get, there's an old man in Gallipoli who shares a dugout with an Anglican chap, and they get on very well. But they don't talk about religion. You know, they get on well, they help each other out, they look after each other, they, you go first or you go first. But they don't get involved in doctrine, in theology or anything like that. And then finally, in March 1919, the Army Chaplains Department was redesignated the Royal Army Chaplains Department by the King in recognition of the work which the Army Chaplains had done on the First World War on the Western Front and elsewhere during the First World War. And you'll notice that the motto in this sign, Conquer, it's Constantine, isn't it, who used that phrase. By the end of the war, that might not quite have been, you know, accurate for many soldiers. What about the atheists? What about the Jews? If you think about it now, if you're going to Afghanistan and you have Muslim troops with you, it's not their motto, is it? So, but still that sign, that cross, that symbol, it survives and is still in use. And it's been in Afghanistan, believe you, and it's been in the Gulf, and it's been in the Falklands, and it's been in Iraq, and it's been in the Second World War. It's been all over the world, because the Army Chaplains, it didn't stop in 1919, it carried on, as did the Navy Chaplaincy, as did the new Royal Air Force Chaplaincy branch, because that was established when the Royal Air Force was established towards the end of the First World War and grew in the interwar period. So despite numerous defence reorganisation, defence cuts, retrenchments and all the rest of it, chaplaincy has always been there. Now we're getting to the state now where the Catholics, we have one Royal Air Force chaplain of about 10 Royal Navy chaplains. I don't think about 20 Catholic chaplains in the Royal Army. But of course as the army comes down and the number of Catholics practising their religion comes down, so the number of Catholic soldiers, service soldiers and airmen and Navy personnel practising their religion, as all that shrinks, so does the need for chaplains. So, finally, there are some aspects which I've said nothing about or very little because obviously we've only had 1 hour. I mentioned very briefly the dual system of organisation on the Western Front in 1915. That caused some kind of disruption, but not too much, because what the Anglicans did was simply put another bishop in charge on the Western Front, and he took all the Anglican chaplains away from him. Dr. Sims, the Presbyterian principal chaplain, went with the others, Rawlinson, etc., etc., and they set up another system. So that was something that really could have done without, because it broke up the organised, integrated system. I mentioned very briefly ecumenism among chaplains, or the lack of it. That's, again, an interesting area of study, but of course, where is the evidence to prove it was either there or it wasn't there? It's very difficult to get the evidence. Conversions to Catholicism among servicemen. Father Rawlinson reckoned there were 40,000 conversions to the Catholic faith on the Western Front in the First World War. 40,000. Now, where did they get that from? What was the motivation for conversion? I would argue that a lot of it came from the chaplains and their quiet devotion, their quiet application, their ministration of the sacraments, and the way in which the Catholic soldiers responded. You have to remember that Catholic priests in those days were largely in urban conurbations where the old Victorian churches had been built and where there were big Catholic populations. Catholic servicemen were probably familiar with the sight of a priest, especially if they went to church. If you were in a parish like mine, there were 5 priests in one parish, and a huge parish, 12,000 people. So you'd be used to priests if you went to church or if you went to a Catholic school. except for Northampton. There were only two or three big places in Northampton. Northampton was a huge diocese. You had Northampton, Ipswich, Norwich, perhaps, and one or two other places. Northampton was a big diocese, extensive diocese. But places like Hexham, Newcastle, Liverpool, Westminster, Southwark, Leeds, you know, big urban areas, lots of priests concentrated together, and there was a familiarity. So the Catholic soldiers would not be unfamiliar with the sight of a priest. Whereas, this is a generalisation of course, Anglican churches, relatively few in urban areas, more in rural areas. Right? And of course, what religion are you? Anglican. Religion, Anglican. Did it mean anything? I don't know, it probably did for some. So there may have been that kind of element in the conversion process, that people saw Catholic troops at ease, comfortable with, receiving spiritual benefits from Catholic chaplains that they weren't getting. And many Anglicans, Anglican chaplains that is, admitted that they'd got nothing to give their soldiers, their dying soldiers. And I think it might have been Ambrose Aegis or certainly another Benedictine from here stressed that. What have they got to give? They've got nothing except perhaps a woodbine, which is a bit harsh, but I know what he meant. The psychological impact of war on priests. Did it affect them? Most certainly it did. Most certainly it did. One priest went back to Northampton and he said to Bishop Keating, Bishop Keating said to him, "Oh, Father, you've had, you know, three hard years in the trenches and on the front, at the front of that kind of thing. I'm going to give you a nice, quiet parish." He said, "My Lord, the last thing I want is a quiet parish. I can't stand, I've been busy for the last 3 years. I want to be kept being busy. Otherwise, I'll be thinking about why I was busy on the Western Front, and that won't be good for me. I want someone to take my mind off what I've just been experiencing for the last 3 years." So there was a post-traumatic stress disorder then, as there is now. How extensive it was, how acute it was, I don't know. I don't think anybody can find out. And what about religion among the troops? Father Charles Plater, some of you may have heard of him, did a study at the end of the war on religion in the army. And, of course, Rawlinson was involved and others were involved. And the government actually set up a commission on the very same topic, religion in the army during the war. And again, Rawlinson was involved and another downside priest was involved. How did the war affect religion, man's religion? Well, some of them lost it altogether. If this is what God does to us, well, I don't want to. Some of them found religion. Some of them had their religion strengthened. Some of them had their religion weakened. So the number of men equals the number of religious experiences. It must do. So that's another big area of research that people have undertaken and continue to undertake. And finally, what was the post-war ministry to the troops who had been at the front? They came home with post-traumatic stress disorder, like everybody else. There'd have been very odd men who didn't, because they must have been changed psychologically, emotionally, religiously, in all kinds of other aspects by their experiences on the Western Front or on the Navy ship or whatever. So did they get any kind of pastoral ministry from the bishops? The answer is no, I don't think they did. Because the priests seemed to come back and go straight into parishes. Well, there were missions when they went, but canon law was introduced in 1917 established parishes in this country. So they went. Some of them would have gone when they were on the mission, but they came back to parishes. And what did they come back to? You know, you could have been on the Western Front for 3 years, be sent to a parish in the middle of Bradford with some crusty old Irishman as your parish priest, who didn't want to know about the First World War, or your experiences, or the British Empire, or the War Memorial. And some didn't. Or you could have come back to somebody who's quite sympathetic. I don't know whether there are, I've not seen any, letters from bishops to their men who serve as chaplains. I would suspect that in this kind of place, the pastoral care of the men who came back could be probably different. First of all, it's a unified system, isn't it? People living in community and what have you, people looking after each other. And maybe being treated slightly differently. I don't know. But it's something that it's worth looking at. So, I've gone on far too long. I always do get excited about these things. So I'll leave it there. Any questions, I'm delighted to answer them. Thank you very much.